Today is Thursday, May 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rebuffed U.S. President Joe Biden's call for a significant reduction in Israel's bombardment of Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip, leading to a ceasefire.
After visiting Israel's military headquarters, Netanyahu said while he greatly appreciates the president's support, he's also determined to continue the operation.
And the European Union says that it will recommend its member countries to allow fully vaccinated visitors from outside the bloc. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. World leaders are increasing their calls for a ceasefire in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. This came after news that an Israeli airstrike killed 11 Gazan children who were being treated for trauma. Humanitarian organizations are concerned about the crisis as the conflict raged for a 10th day Wednesday, pushing the Palestinian death toll to more than 220 people, including more than 60 children. U.S. President Joe Biden stepped up the pressure on Israel to end 10 days of violent skirmishes with Palestinians, making clear in a call Wednesday with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he expected significant de-escalation very soon. But Netanyahu has brushed off Biden's push. AP's Sega Magani reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is pushing back against President Biden's call to wind down a fierce military offensive in the Gaza Strip. In a morning call, the White House says the president told Netanyahu he expected a significant de-escalation today after visiting Israel's military headquarters. Netanyahu said while he greatly appreciates the president's support, he's also determined to continue the operation. That marks the first public rift between the U.S. and Israel since the fighting started last week. The president had until now avoided publicly pushing Israel for a ceasefire amid continuing rocket fire by Hamas militants. Sagar Magani, Washington.
In the U.S. Congress, there is a sharp divide between Democrats and Republicans over President Joe Biden's handling of what is being seen as his administration's first major foreign policy crisis. My colleague Kate Pound-Dawson earlier spoke with VOA Capitol Hill correspondent Catherine Gibson on these differences.
Right. Well, this is one of those interesting issues that has really united Republicans because it gives them something to point to for the very first time in terms of President Biden's foreign policy and point to something and say, look, this is where he really differs from former President Donald Trump. We think that Biden has made a number of moves just in the last 4 months that he's been in the White House that have really escalated the situation. And they really are not liking the way he's kind of what they say is towing the line and not giving enough support to Israel. They're saying that he's actually hassling Netanyahu in Israel and not giving enough of a public-facing support to say, look, Israel is a U.S. ally, and we need to support them in this moment, this trying moment.
Is there much difference between the two major parties' positions?
In terms of the differences between Republicans and Democrats, they could not be farther apart. Republicans obviously are saying that Biden is mishandling this crisis, that the U.S., if anything, needs to stand stronger with Israel. Well, there are some really interesting divides developing over in the Democratic Party where you're seeing a split between the moderates and the progressives on how the U.S. needs to deal with Israel. And what we're seeing is that moderate Democrats are calling for a ceasefire, which Republicans say is actually a failure of leadership because they see a ceasefire as basically accepting that there's a moral equivalence between the state of Israel and Hamas and the Palestinian people. Well, meanwhile, the progressives are pushing the moderate Democrats even farther to the left and saying, look, we need to really condemn Israel's actions. So this is a very tricky issue for all of the lawmakers involved up on Capitol Hill.
So it sounds like not only are the differences between the parties, they are within the parties. Are there differences in how the Republicans are seeing it? within their party.
Yeah, not as many splits among the Republicans, and I really think that's a function of the fact that there's a Democrat in the White House, so it's a lot easier to kind of unite around this idea that, look, we have a Democratic president, and all of us Republicans think that he's mishandling the situation. You really see the divides over on the side of the Democratic Party, where a lot of Democrats, especially like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, some of those progressives who want to see a more forceful U.S. approach to Israel, who are actually calling for a full reevaluation of American aid and are trying to block this upcoming $735 million U.S. arms sale to Israel, they're trying to push the Biden administration further and further to the left, which is something that we're really not likely going to see from Biden. He knows how the U.S. Senate and the U.S. Congress works. He spent decades up on Capitol Hill. He is not going to be giving into that pressure from the left.
That was Catherine Gibson, VOA Capitol Hill correspondent. She was speaking with International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson. Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday attacked New York State's Attorney General for launching a criminal probe of his family business. Trump said that he was, quote, being unfairly attacked and abused. He said, quote, we will overcome any attempt at prosecution. On Tuesday, the New York State Attorney General said her office had been conducting a criminal investigation into whether the Trump Organization falsely reported property values to obtain tax and other advantages. Julie Walker with AP has more.
The New York Attorney General's office says the investigation into former President Trump's business empire is now a criminal one. It had been purely a civil probe. In a statement, the AG's office says we are now actively investigating the Trump Organization in a criminal capacity, along with the Manhattan District Attorney. The office did not give an explanation for what prompted the change. The DA's investigation has been going on for 2 years. Trump's taxes have come up in both investigations, along with whether Trump or his businesses manipulated the value of assets to gain favorable loans and tax benefits. In the past, the Republican ex-president has said the investigations are part of a Democratic witch hunt. Julie Walker, New York.
The company that owns a major fuel pipeline in the United States says that it did pay a ransom to criminals who infected its computers with ransomware. AP's Jennifer King has more.
The CEO of Colonial Pipeline told the Wall Street Journal he authorized a payment of $4.4 million in cryptocurrency to a gang of hackers who broke into its computer systems. Sources have told the Associated Press that in exchange for the ransom, Colonial received the software decryption key required to unscramble their data network. Joseph Blount told the Journal he knew it was a controversial decision, but he felt it was the right thing to do for the country. He agreed to the payment because the company didn't know the extent of the damage and wasn't sure how long it would take to bring the systems back online. The shutdown on May 7th led to panic buying and shortages at gas stations from Washington, D.C. to Florida. Jennifer King, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The United States announced this week that it will share an additional 20 million coronavirus vaccine doses with other countries, in addition to the 60 million it has already committed. But where are the vaccine going? Well, that remains a question unanswered, as VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
There are two things that the State Department Coordinator for Global COVID Response made clear Wednesday about the 80 million vaccine doses the U.S. government is dispatching around the globe. One, they haven't decided who gets what, which is a fact that Gail Smith stressed in a rapid-fire teleconference in which journalists from the Caribbean, India, Brazil, Africa, East Asia, and the European Union asked that same question repeatedly and with varying degrees of urgency, as many nations stare down yet another wave of the deadly virus. Smith emphasized the U.S. is working closely with the global COVAX facility to determine where the vaccines are needed most and how they can be most equitably distributed.
We have not made the decisions on allocations yet. We'll have that information for you sometime in the near term. What we are doing is looking at every region in the world, and we are well aware of the extremely low vaccine coverage on the African continent.
The other point Smith emphasized, despite the fact that the U.S.'s top adversaries, China and Russia, are ramping up their own vaccine donations around the world, this move by the U.S. is not a case of vaccine diplomacy. Smith stressed repeatedly that the U.S. will distribute according to need and not to curry favor.
Our view with respect to vaccine diplomacy, and I think a really important point here, is that vaccines are tools for public health. They are the means for bringing this pandemic to an end. We do not see them, do not intend to use them as means for influence or pressure. And our decisions will be made on the basis of need, public health data, and again, collaboration with key partners, absolutely, including COVAX.
However, Smith did note that the U.S. is the biggest donor of vaccines to the COVAX facility and urged other wealthy nations to step up. She also noted that this vaccine donation will be accompanied by investments in vaccine manufacturing sites around the world and U.S. assistance to improve other countries' access to therapeutics and testing. What this is, to put it simply, as President Joe Biden did this week, is a case of that old kindergarten adage, sharing is caring.
There's a lot of talk about Russian-China influence in the world with vaccines. We want to lead the world with our values, with this demonstration of our innovation and ingenuity and the fundamental decency of the American people. Just as in World War II, America was the arsenal of democracy in the battle against COVID-19 pandemic, our nation is going to be the arsenal of vaccines for the rest of the world. We'll share these vaccines in the service of ending the pandemic everywhere. And we will not use our vaccines to secure favors from other countries. We'll work with COVAX, the international organization set up, and other partners to ensure that the vaccines are delivered in a way that is equitable and that follows the science and the public health data.
So the White House says this is not a race for global domination. This is, however, a race for global immunity, a race in which, unusually and wonderfully, everyone wins. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Iraqi mediators have been working patiently behind the scenes to try and bring about a diplomatic reconciliation between longtime adversaries Iran and Saudi Arabia in recent weeks and months. No immediate breakthrough appears on the horizon, but the intermittent talks may have achieved a minor though. Edward Yeranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Iraqi President Barham Saleh has told Arab media that improved ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia would be beneficial for Baghdad and the rest of the region.
For Iraq to be able to play that convenient role between these regional actors is important. The theme is a stable, sovereign Iraq is a common interest of our neighbors. Instead of Iraq being a source of instability, let it be the common binding theme for bringing the region together.
The comments come amid reports that Saudi intelligence chief Khalid al-Hamaydan met with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Quds Forces leader Ismail Kaani in Baghdad last month. It was not clear what progress was made, if any. Saudi Arabia and Iran have been battling each other through their regional proxies in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen for a number of years. Last week, Saudi anti-aircraft batteries shot down nearly a dozen drones and missiles fired by pro-Iranian Houthi rebels from Yemen into the southern Saudi region of Najran. Saudi officials have repeatedly accused Iran of supplying rockets, missiles, and drones to the rebels in Yemen. Iran supports the rebels but denies supplying them with weapons. Separately, Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan al-Saud has told journalists that, among other things, Riyadh wants Tehran to resume compliance with key facets of the 2015 nuclear accord with the five permanent United Nations Security Council member states plus Germany. The agreement was designed to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons.
We hope that we will see an Iran that comes back into compliance and that agrees to address the concerns that we have, both about the deficiencies in the previous JCPOA structure, but also, of course, regional stability and ballistic missiles and other issues.
Iran says its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Retired Columbia University professor and former U.S. diplomat Gary Sick tells VOA he thinks that it's always a positive sign when Iran and Saudi Arabia are negotiating, but that he does not anticipate any immediate breakthrough.
Although we apparently had one or two meetings between the Iranians and the Saudis, the progress, if any, has been extremely glacial, and I certainly don't think that this is going to result in an embrace between these two rival powers anywhere in the near future.
Sik thinks that ultimately it would be possible for Iran and Saudi Arabia to find a modus vivendi, as they did several decades ago when former Iranian President Hashemi Rafsanjani negotiated an agreement with Saudi Crown Prince and later King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz. Washington-based Gulf analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that he thinks part of the incentive to find a working arrangement between Saudi Arabia and Iran revolves around the United States shifting its focus of attention from the Middle East to the Indo-Pacific region. Saudi Arabia and Iran, he says, are attempting to find ways to cooperate in a non-political, non-religious manner in domains which include transportation, entertainment, investment, and family relations for a better future. He adds that both Iraq and Oman are involved in the talks and that Qatar wants to get involved too. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told journalists during a visit to the Syrian capital Damascus last week that he would like to see a normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh.
We certainly are ready and have always been ready for close ties with Saudi Arabia. We've had some contacts with Saudi Arabia, and we hope that these contacts will come to fruition through greater cooperation between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Former diplomat Sik says he was surprised to see Iraq leading efforts to mediate an accord between the two rivals of the Islamic world, but points out that Tehran claimed its late military commander, General Qasem Soleimani, killed by a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad in 2020, was carrying a message to Saudi Arabia when he died. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Negotiators leading indirect talks to bring the United States and Iran back into the nuclear deal say that a deal is shaping up. The talks have been going on since early April. The U.S. and Iranian diplomats are not meeting each other directly. The negotiators are expected to meet again in Vienna, Austria, early next week. The goal is to find a way back to the 2015 accord to limit Iran's nuclear development program, which former U.S. President Donald Trump walked away from. The European Union announced Wednesday that it would recommend its member countries to allow fully vaccinated visitors from outside the bloc. European Commission spokesman Christian Wingard told reporters in Brussels that ambassadors of the EU's 27 member states agreed to ease the criteria for nations to be considered a safe country from which all people can travel. Currently, only seven nations are considered safe based on their COVID-19 infection rates. VOA's International Edition continues. Italy was one of the world's hardest hit nations at the start of the pandemic. As the Italian government continues to lift COVID-19 travel restrictions, the country's art cities are starting to see a return to tourists in their museums, galleries, and bars and restaurants. The numbers are far from those of the past, but there is an air of optimism that pervades the squares and streets in cities like Florence, so badly in need of a return to visitors. Sabina Casofranco reports from Florence.
COVID-19 infections and deaths have been on a steady decline in Italy in recent weeks, and the Italian government has decided the curbs in place to limit the spread of the virus can gradually be relaxed across the country. Vaccinations are also continuing at a steady pace, and in the country that suffered the second highest death toll in Europe after Britain, there is a general feeling of optimism among the population. In art cities like Florence, that have suffered a huge toll from the lack of tourism, visitors have started to trickle back as museums and galleries reopen their doors. Monica Milandri runs a small 14-room boutique hotel right next to the Gucci restaurant in an enviable position, the central Piazza della Signoria.
solo esclusivamente italiani e ovviamente molti però fanno la giornata, quindi per
She says that for the time being bookings have been forthcoming exclusively from Italians, most who come for the day or stay just one night, and for the moment these arrivals are just over the weekend. Milandri says some hotels in Florence, particularly smaller ones, will not be reopening anytime soon after the huge losses they suffered because of COVID-19. The virus, she says, has caused tremendous damage to the sector.
Soltanto noi abbiamo fatto 92% in meno di fatturato.
She says her hotel alone has lost 92% of its traffic compared to 2019. She fears this year it will not be easy to return to the numbers of the past. Italians, she says, do not normally visit art cities in the summer, so her hope is for a return of foreign travelers as soon as possible. But as one walks in front of the beauty of Florence's Duomo and the exquisite bell tower by Giotto, the bars and restaurants in the square have gone back to being populated, and many are enjoying their cappuccinos sitting in the sun at the tables outside, a sight that had been forgotten. The eerie emptiness of recent months has gone. All of Italy's 20 regions, apart from one in the north of the country, Valle d'Aosta, have been placed in the low-risk yellow level, and the government has announced further easing of restrictions in the coming weeks. A nightly 10 o'clock curfew is being extended immediately to 1 hour later and to midnight on June 7th, and then lifted altogether from June 21st. Gyms will reopen next, and from June, restaurants will also be able to serve customers indoors and not just outdoors. But for the moment, masks and social distancing remain mandatory. In a further effort to reopen the country to tourism, mandatory quarantine for arrivals from European Union countries, Britain and Israel, has been removed, providing visitors pass a negative COVID-19 test. US airlines are providing COVID-19 safe flights requiring testing to Italy. The country is ready to welcome foreigners back as it awaits a European Union Green Pass scheme which will further facilitate safe movement between countries. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Florence.
After protests against police violence in France, tens of thousands of officers and their supporters staged their own rally in Paris Wednesday, demanding tougher measures against violence and insecurity that have targeted their ranks. From the French capital, Lisa Bryant reports that ahead of elections, the demonstration took political overtones.
Police, politicians, and ordinary Parisians braved a mix of sun and pelting rain to protest outside France's National Assembly Wednesday.
Actuellement en France, on a beaucoup de policiers qui sont morts ces derniers mois.
29-year-old Laurent Bazin, whose parents are in the military, said he wanted to show solidarity with the police, who have died just doing their daily jobs because they were police.
Il fallait terroriser les terroristes. Il est temps surtout.
Earlier this month, an officer was killed during an anti-drugs operation in Nice. Another worker was killed as she entered the police station outside Paris in a suspected Islamist terrorist attack, one of several such attacks targeting French police in recent years. Police aren't the only ones raising alarm about growing insecurity in France. Members of France's military community, active and retired, have published a pair of open letters recently warning of what they allege could be a brewing civil war fueled by growing Islamism.
Mais on est une police républicaine et ça c'est important et c'est pour ça qu'on était tous là.
This officer, who declined to give his name, said France's police force is committed to protecting citizens but isn't treated the way it deserves. He worries peace is unraveling in France. The demonstration offered a counterpoint to allegations of police violence and racial profiling that have surged with the Black Lives Matter movement. Politicians from a rainbow of parties were out in force ahead of regional elections next month and presidential and legislative ones next year. But the welcome wasn't always warm. Some booed French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin as he arrived. Darmanin said he was simply there to support the officers during a difficult time. There's nothing more normal, he added, than supporting officers in a republic.
La victime doit revenir au centre du procès pénal.
Not everyone agreed with that sentiment. Some French experts said it was highly unusual for him to be present.
Non, je pense qu'il a voulu venir en tant que citoyen, peut-être aujourd'hui.
But one demonstrator, Ludovic, said he believed Darmanin came as an ordinary citizen. He said police needed more political support. Members of France's main opposition party, the far-right National Rally, were also present, along with leftist politicians. But the far-left France Unbound party refused to attend, saying it did not share the police demands. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Malawi is to ban more than 19,000 doses of the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine after slow uptake led to their expiration. Authorities are struggling to administer remaining doses set to expire in June and are training mobile health workers to visit and inoculate communities. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
The public installation of the vaccine Wednesday in the capital was held in front of officials from the Treasury, Anti-Corruption Bureau, the Auditor General's Office, and health rights activists. Speaking during the event at Kamuzu Central Hospital, Health Minister Khumbize Kandodo Chiponda said the distraction was aimed to build public confidence in the safety of the vaccination program.
It has been very difficult, you know, to convince Malawians about the vaccine initially because of a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and the negative propaganda. So we just want to assure Malawians that indeed what we had said that we're going to destroy them, it is happening now.
Kandodo Chiponda said the move is also in line with government policy, which prohibits the use of any expired health commodities. The expired vaccines were part of 102,000 vaccines Malawi received from the African Union on March 26, with an expiration date of April 13. Dr. Charles Mwansambo is the health secretary. He said despite the slow uptake of the vaccine, the expiration was also because of the vaccine's short shelf life by the time the government received the donation. He said although the remaining doses are expected to expire in June and July, the government will see to it that the vaccines do not expire again.
We have a policy where we say first in, first out, first expiry, first out. So for those vaccines expiring end of June, they are the ones that we use first, and the ones in end of July, we will use them later. So we don't see this happening again.
He said to increase the vaccine uptake, the government has trained additional health workers to reach out to communities normally unable to access medical facilities that are providing vaccines. In addition, he said the government has increased the number of vaccination centers across the country. George Jobe is the executive director for the Malawi Health Equity Network. He says low vaccine uptake is more prevalent in rural areas where myths and misconceptions about COVID-19 are prevalent.
In the cities, we saw huge numbers, long numbers of people, queues to be vaccinated. But in the communities, we need to do more sensitization, responding and clarifying on the misconceptions.
Minister of Health Chiponda says Malawi is expected to receive about 900,000 additional doses of AstraZeneca vaccines under a COVAX facility in June. Lamik Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London!
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings,